Insecurity Podcast. And Vicky's fight to the last. Inside and the know-how. We take the challenge now.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Security MVP Insight series within the Talking Security Podcast. I'm Frans Oudendorp, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Puyan Gabazi. We're thrilled to bring you the third episode in our series, where we continue to explore the fascinating world of cybersecurity.
Thanks, Frans. In this series, we delve into global and local cybersecurity challenges, provide expert insights on emerging trends, and showcase innovation solutions from our security MVPs.
Yeah, for today's episode, we have an exceptional guest with us. Matthias Borg is a highly regarded security architect, Microsoft MVP, and an expert in cloud security. Matthias has extensive experience in designing and implementing robust security solutions for organizations of all sizes, and we're eager to hear his insights.
Yes, and in addition to his work as a security architect, Matthias is a great speaker and writer, contributing to various industry conferences and publications. He also shares his expertise through his blog at blog.sec-labs.com. We will add that to the description as well. We are excited to have him on the show to discuss some of the key cybersecurity challenges and trends he's observed the last years.
So let's jump into our conversation. Matthias, welcome to the Security MVP Insights. We're delighted to have you here. To start things off, could you tell us a bit about your current role at OneFin and what your typical day looks like?
Well, thank you for having me. I'm super happy to be on the show. I work with OneFin in a Swedish-based company. And I work in our MDR service as a threat hunter and also doing consultant work on the side. I don't know the exact like percentage how much working in the service and how much is consultant work. Lately on the consultant side, I've been a lot of offensive securities. We've been doing a lot of penetration testing, both from a red team perspective and also black teaming, so the physical assessments. The first half of this year, I've been really, really busy, which is it's super fun and I enjoy every day.
And nice. And we're talking about a lot of stuff, but before that, we are recording this as a podcast, but also as a video that we'll publish on YouTube. And I know you're also doing a podcast in Sweden, I guess.
Yes, the Security Dojo. Thank you for letting me doing some commercial work. We have recorded a few episodes. We do it when we have the time.
So nice.
Sounds great.
Working for OneFin, being an MVP, in a Microsoft MVP, and we're recording that this at Tuesday. What is it? 9th July, July 9th, and I guess tomorrow is a big day. We're all rewarded, and if not, then we will have to continue the stuff that we are doing. But maybe you can share a bit about the background that you have. What is your technology background? And with that, how did you become a Microsoft security MVP in the last few years?
Yeah, absolutely. And also something I want to add to the, from the MVP community is, we do a lot of contributions to the different technology communities. But I think that's like the foundation, being able to share within the community, and the MVP award is something that comes on top of that, according to myself, where you get recognized for the work you're actually doing besides working towards the recognition. So for me, I think it's the most important is the being able to share with the community and also learn from the community, because that's how I learned from the beginning, from the community, asking questions and so on. And then And then after some time, when you started to share yourself and share knowledge and so on with the community. And for me, when it started, is I was working for, I'm not sure if I should start with my background or the MVP thingy. Let's start with my background. I've been working with IT since like forever, since when we had civil wars in Sweden or something.
It was by Matthias. When we, before this recording, we had a short conversation and I asked you, what are your hobbies? And that's a bit of the same of telling about your background, I guess, because what was your hobby is security. So maybe that helps a bit within the background.
Yeah. Yeah. So I've been doing computer stuff since school. The IT department looked a bit different at the time. Usually we're one the IT guys, and you were doing like support, building new stuff and whatever. And so I've been doing that for a really long time, since 2000 something. I think I left school 2001 and then started to work straight after that. And then over the years, I've been more interested in security. And started to think about security when designing new systems, and at the time also thinking about how can you break the system. So always been one leg in the defensive side and one in the offensive side. And I think from some perspective it could be a good thing to know how the other side is working. And then since I don't know what I want to be when I grew up, I still keep one leg in each. I started to many years ago. I worked with another SIEM platform, starting with S, and that was
with
yeah, ends with punk. before Microsoft started to. Before we had Sentinel in the first preview, and when I heard about Sentinel being something, I think it was in early preview, I tried to get in touch with the product team and tried to send out as much feedback as I could, and I brought the things that I thought Splunk was doing good at the time, and things that might have been missing from Sentinel. From that's sort of where I come from. And also when at the time Windows ATP, I think that was the first name, right? Windows Defender ATP or something, before it became Microsoft Defender ATP, and now of Defender for Endpoint. So I got access through one of my best friends in the community to a tenant, and I was able to do some labbing before, because I was working at the customer side at the time, and we didn't use that. We didn't use Defender, but I saw the potentials, what it could do, and started to provide feedback continuously, and did a lot of testing back and forth and see what could be done. And so I was super happy when the hunting feature came, the first one. The absolute first one that we could do was the search bar at the top, before we had the advanced hunting. When we got advanced hunting, I started to dive into Custo. Since I came from another platform with a well-developed query language, and I've also come in touch with other SIEM platforms that doesn't have this well-developed language, it was a relief to see how extensive Custo is and how much you can do with it. So from a perspective where you have the EDR data, and when you were working with the other SIEM platform, we didn't have access to EDR data. It was Sysmon at the best, most commonly were some like network logs and other things related, like more old school network security monitoring. So when we got the EDR data and was able to use a like powerful language to query that data, I started to like imagine how it can be in the future, like, oh, we can do all these kind of things. And I was super impressed of what we could do. Another thing also with from a background perspective is I mean, I don't only do IT. I have some hobbies, and my hobbies changes sometimes. Yeah, or IT. I've always tried to have like some hobby that doesn't involve the computer. So I never have time for that hobby, regardless of what it is. I brought back like DJing sometime. Bought this cool stuff, but I didn't have time with it. And then I think it was like 4 or 5 years ago, I thought that, oh, maybe painting with airbrush is fun. So I bought my like the small this airbrush things and like a compressor and everything, and started to do that, and realized I don't have time for this either, but it's fun.
Nice. And so when we look at your background, Matthias, I mean, it's a very broad expertise domain. But if you would focus on some primary elements in there where you are focusing now your expertise mainly on, definitely on the Microsoft technology, but also with a link to the cybersecurity, what areas are you mainly focused on these days? I hope no. Yeah. S and then Plunk anymore.
Yeah, I don't want to work with any other tools Defender XDR. And if I have listeners who are not into like the unified security experience, we have Defender on one side and Sentinel, but now we bring them together in one nice portal. But if we're gonna do like more like on a holistic perspective, I would say my primary focus is threat hunting and like finding advanced threats and on the incident response side. Operational cybersecurity. During a few years, there were so many companies that wanted to deploy Defenders. We did a lot of deployments to get the organizations started to use their licenses, both on the endpoint side, Defender for Identity, Defender for Office, and so on and so forth. But I've always, in these deployments, I always had this focus on teaching the customers how they should work with this from a operational perspective, because I've seen a lot of organizations that it's more that they're looking for this checkbox in their like compliance checklist. Yes, we have EDR. Yes, we have X, Y, and Z. So I've always had this focus to make sure that they understand that they need to work with these tools. It's not a hat you put on a day a week or of a week or something like that. You need to work with it continuously. And so that's an important part of it as well. Deploy the tools is, I mean, that's the easy part, but get the organization behind it so you can, and the organizational structure to actually work with it. That's sort of the challenge that I see.
And yeah, I mean, we see similar behavior here as well, right? Because we have also some law and regulations that are enforcing companies, definitely government organizations, to go towards a SIEM or a certain solutions. And often they are just, not all of them, of course, but some of them are just trying to check box that, like, we have a SIEM and then we are done with it. And instead of really realizing what you can achieve with it, actually.
Yeah, exactly. And the same thing with if we look at it from a Sentinel perspective, where maybe enabling like the some of the built-in connectors and stuff, and But there's so many other log sources if they want to have like visibility into all their systems. They would need to have these custom logs, web logs, and all kinds of things. And so they need to ingest that kind of data as well. And then there's always this classic discussion, what should we do with the firewall logs? Love that one.
Let's part. I think we will hit that in a moment as well, because that's a really nice one. That's a global question, I think.
Yeah, but, I think should we solve that for everyone?
I think it was in the first recording that we picked out this point already. So let's park that one.
There's some other things we're working on as well. Should we go into there?
Yeah, go ahead.
Me and a colleague, Martin, we had done a few presentations on security automation. So SOAR, basically. It's a fun story how it started. He's like this super automation person. It's crazy. And he had done some home automation that is like out of the world, fun and crazy stuff. And I realized that, oh, he might be able to do something, voice something. And Sentinel has APIs. So he did all the coding. I was like the person with all the ideas. And so we did like a 100% voice controlled Sentinel instance.
You're kidding. That's amazing.
I still have the demo recorded, actually. It's great. And so using an Alexa speaker and voice, so, and like Sonos speakers, we were able to like get a voice message when there are new incidents, and then like IKEA light bulb flashing, and then using an IKEA button to like acknowledge the incident, and but then the voice control, so like Alexa, open Sentinel, respond to incident one, and it actually worked. It wasn't like staged or anything. All the steps was actually working, and we continued to think about that, like, all right, how should you build a SOAR framework? And so we started to like bring in all like the knowledge we have from previous automation projects, and for myself working with SOAR previously, and like where is it failing? So we took those things, and we weren't that structured that we actually wrote it down, but made a list sort of, and started to address the things. And so now we have designed a SOAR framework, like the boiling plate, which is built up on like modular structure. So you're reusing modules, and you have your orchestration, and everything runs in Azure.
Wow.
So that was, so we did another like 2.0 of the extreme SOAR thing. So we did with, it was actually fun. So we did it with, we used the live response API and took a webcam picture. And then we analyzed the picture.
Of the
user triggering the incident, like a phishing email or something. Okay. We took a webcam picture. This was, in a lab environment for the demo only. And sent the image to DeepStack for picture analysis. Like, oh no, it's a wine glass. The user is drunk, and then took actions based on that. But I was more like doing like the fun, crazy things to show that people need to start working with SOAR. And so we used the framework to build all the orchestrations and logics. And then, but since it was a demo, we need to like go out of bounds doing some fun with it.
No, but do you think, Matthias, that we have now for 5 years, a little bit more than 5 years, Sentinel around. Of course, SOAR was one of the big pilers when they announced it, and a lot of organizations went for it, but nobody did really soar. It was more integration and enrichment. Do you think after 5 years that the time is come that we focus more now the detections and the hunting is more? I think we can agree that we have reached a higher level of quality of our detections in general. The ones that are in community and shared by Microsoft do really have good quality detections, and mostly that it's time to investigate in the SOAR. And if so, how would you advise organizations to go towards that? Maybe
I see there are like two schools, but there are different ways of approaching this, and I think it's the same thing when adapting new detections. A classical thing is like you had all this the detection templates, the analytic rules in Sentinel, and one approach that some organization used was to like enable all of them, just click it through, enable, and then deal with it when it fires. But the other way, which I think is more correct way of doing it, even if I've been doing both ways because it's fun to get the incidents right, the full way back is to what is the requirement of the security team? What are the business requirements for you to be able to detect, and for how long back do you need to be able to investigate? Because that sets sort of the requirements for your operations. So for instance, let's say, yeah, we need to be able to detect anomalies in sign-ins and we want to go back 90 days, for example. All right, so then we know we need to have 90 days retention. It could be regulatory requirements that require you to have more retention. So then you have like the requirements, and then you start building the use case. So you have like the with Word explaining your actual use case, what the goal is, and then when you have the goal, you realize, all right, in which logs do we have the data that's required to detect this? It could be let's bring up the firewall again, right? maybe it could be like IIS log, or it could be Apache log, whatever, any log, and then you develop the query for it. But it's so easy since we come from the tech side, it's more fun to start building a query.
Yeah.
Which I think is like the wrong way of doing it. I think we should always start with the use case and the business requirements. But in reality, no one from the business can explain like what they actually have as a requirement. So from a cybersecurity perspective, they should decide and like have these discussions with the business lead, for example. But that is, if you do it that way, you have the budget with you as well, all the way. Because no one can say like, oh, this security monitoring tools we have are like too expensive or whatever. But we have this requirement. We need to have these things in place. Otherwise, we're not fulfilling our requirements that we promised the business. So there are a lot of things there that's super important. And the same thing. I slided a bit from SOAR. I realized that. But from a SOAR perspective, it's also I think it's important that you don't just end up in, oh, this is a cool automation. This is a logic app. Let's deploy this and deploy that.
Yeah.
That's why we developed the frameworks. You should have some organizations and some standards around how you do things. So for example, we have some we work with some organizations that haven't migrated and have the emails in 0365, so they're still using on-prem, and they have this SMTP connector or whatever, and so if they started to build automations that should send emails, let's say they have 50 playbooks that's somewhat using emails, and if they develop all these and download from the community and whatever, they end up in a scenario where maybe the exchange team makes a change and they start moving to 0365 and closes that SMTP connector. if you've had like 10 different people building all these playbooks and everyone has done it in their way, some of them will start failing. But if you have one way of sending an email in one module, you only need to change that. And then you can invoke that in all playbooks where you need to send email, as an example. So I think the world start, well, the world, I think the organizations I'm working with are starting to become more mature and they're more ready for working with automation as a cleaning up the like the easy incidents or alert fatigue and so on.
Go ahead, Bojan.
So no, I just wanted to say the SOAR topic. I think it's a beautiful topic, and we can really continue. We really need to do a different episode, like a 2-hour show, and then talk on that as well. To come a little bit back from the SOAR, if it's okay, and then focus more on the general side, Matthias. Because I think it's a good bridge, right? The SOAR is a huge where companies are growing. But do you see other challenges at this moment? And so what are the biggest cybersecurity challenges on a global scale today, in your opinion?
I think that the main challenge that I see, at least, is the lack of human resources. We don't have enough people in the business. I'm not sure how it is in the Netherlands, but in Sweden and some other countries where I know that they're spending a lot of time trying to find resources to hire. It's super hard.
And Matthias, throwing in the AI stuff, talking about co-pilots, can that help regarding these challenges that you are talking about?
Yeah, we have the co-pilot for security. When was it GA? Was it April 1st or something?
Yeah, April 1st.
Yep. And so I definitely think that AI is, future-wise, AI is definitely a key player. I think it will change a lot. I don't think it will... that we should be afraid of our work and our jobs in general. I think it's a helping tool, and I'm sure the organizations that think that AI will replace all the employees in security. That won't happen. Not that I see. Not before we have the real Skynet or something. I think that. It definitely helps, and I think it helps for all three of us that have been working in the industry for some time. I think it helps us in a different way than it helps someone who comes direct from school on his first job in cybersecurity. For instance, people that come from school now, they have not seen on-prem infrastructure that much. That we've seen, for example, and for them to maybe ask for some clarifications, get some quick assist in explaining some stuff. I think that's definitely a help for that, and also with some since it's AI, it's difficult to put standardized and AI in the same sentence because it's based on AI. But I think that AI can help in when we do. The investigation, especially for with Copilot for Security, where we can have this prompt books that asks the same questions when you execute it, and it makes it easier for someone new into the industry to start understanding and learning, and then of course for us the old folks in the business to help with stuff that just takes time and material.
Yeah.
That you can't take any shortcuts. For instance, reverse engineering. We've seen there's a lot of talks on how to use AI to reverse engineer code from assembly instructions to the proper source code. I've tried it for a few like smaller test applications, and it's 100% in the source code I get back. So I think for those kind of tasks that you still need to do it, we get forward much faster with AI as a helping resource for that. And also, as you mentioned, with the lack of people in the business, I think AI is also something that could help us keep us floating for some time.
You need to do stuff with a minimal amount of people, and with that, AI can help to have more rapid response times and so on.
Something that we had with AutoIR some time ago, even if it wasn't like AI, we still had the scaling with AutoIR in Defender. So I think that helps as well. But as Stefan Sjöling said some time back, was that there was this question if we can take people from the street and put in front of AI and have them doing cybersecurity work. I can't remember, I can't quote him 100%, but as I, what I made out of it is like, people can drive without the driving license. Can we let people drive a car without the driving license, sort of?
Yeah.
And I think that's really wise, because if you don't understand the question, you can't validate the answer.
Yeah. And if you can, if you not have driving lessons, you can drive, you try to, and you probably drive the car in a good way. And if you point that on AI and cybersecurity, probably you do the right action based on the question and the answer that is there, but you're not knowing that for sure.
Exactly. And, you still, yeah, sir.
Yeah, yeah. And talking about AI, rapid response times, but also automation, what is the balance, and how do you approach the balance between them? So between rapid response times and automation.
I would say automation. From my perspective, is that instead of you get the incident and you want to look up A, B, and C, for example, then you, if you have automation, you can get the, and for instance, you want to enrich some data from your workspace, you want to check the IP against some database somewhere, you want to ask some third-party API for some data, and instead of having the analyst to do that that hands-on work, which even if it goes fast and you know exactly what to do, it's much quicker to open incident, like read the result of those activities, and then make the decision out of there. So I don't see necessarily SOAR as a like end-to-end where it actually closes everything. Since you still have like the manual review. And I think from an AI perspective, we can use AI on top of that to, I mean, do a first washing, and then you have at the, like some of the manual, when you have need a human to look into some things, you can have AI, and you in the beginning, you can have let AI score the things for you. And then when you do review of previous incidents, you can look at the scoring and the actual decision and see like how AI differs from the humans. You can, I haven't done too much research into AI, how to train and those kind of things. I'm happy with the tools provided. We have some people looking into like the training part and stuff, but the, but I think from that perspective, you can see how it would act, and then you can slowly let it take its own actions, for example. And the same thing with asking Copilot for advice or for enrichment. I think the response from that can be, I think that it can help a lot, but it's still like a helping source.
Amazing. And look, focusing on that AI and maybe to leave that out in the next topic, but if we look forward to the coming few years, what trends do you foresee in the cybersecurity landscape? I think we had our DDoS periods, we had our ransomware, huge ransomwares, and that's taking a little bit down. And what's in your opinion coming years that organizational people really need to be careful, taking consideration?
I think as long as the ransomware threat actors, if we group them to all the different parts of a actor group, both in terms of the access resellers and everything, as long as everyone is making money, I don't think we will see an end of that. So I think that's like a something that will continue for like the near future, at least until they don't make any money. Because money is the driving point for it. And we also have the world is changing a lot. Sweden is finally a member of NATO. Thank you for that. there's this conflict raising around the world. We have the Israel conflict and Palestinian conflict. We have things happening around China. We have Russia, Ukraine, or Russia, rest of the world thing. We have North South Korea. So there's a lot of conflicts that keep on popping up. So I think like and the cyber attacks, they're ongoing and have been for a long time. But I think if the conflicts become more frequent, I think we will have even more cyber attacks. So I think the frequency will increase a lot, and maybe more attacks against infrastructure. We've seen that in like in Ukraine, but I think that will be more frequent. This is 100% guessing, but I think that will also start happening in other countries for due to supporting of this and this and that country.
Do you think, Matthias, do you think that nation state attacks, instead of groups that are active or probably active for a country, that nation state attacks will be more and more bigger than the other attacks?
I don't have any data on which one will be bigger. Well, it's impossible to the money is always like a key factor, of course, but if a country, especially in a war state, I think that's definitely something that could be a key, because that could turn the whole war if one side seems to be winning and so on. So I think that's definitely something. A lot of countries is highly into already, and I think other countries maybe will turn into looking more in that direction at least. And also, the industrial espionage, we've also had that for a long time. I'm not sure how that, in general, works when there's an active conflict, if it increases or decreases. I have no idea. But I could, imagination, I could see that maybe the espionage is not that, it's more effective to break some infrastructure components than getting some documents from organization.
Yeah, but
if it's not defense things.
Yeah, but looking at the history, all the innovative solutions were popping up when there was an incident in the world. Looking at World War II, from that point, we have the back engines on the in the airplanes. That was the exposure that was there, and probably with the Ukrainian war, with Israel, Gaza, and so on and so on, probably we have now the time, and I don't know, but now it's maybe the time to have some exposure within the cybersecurity area.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's everything we do affects everything related, especially when it comes to, new defense capabilities will absolutely change the threat actor, because they need to change. I mean, it is this continuously cat and mouse game, and I don't see that change.
No, definitely not. We need to finish up because we are a bit underway. A normal topic within this podcast, Matthias, is the AI question. So what we have done, we're putting in all your details, like your professional background, your current role, your achievements, your contribution, your name, and so on. So sorry for that privacy leak, but we put it in ChatGPT or Copilot, an AI version, and then we let that AI version make a question for you. And the following question was there for you. Matthias, with your expertise on Microsoft Defender XDR, how does your airbrush painting hobby influence your approach to cybersecurity?
Oh, well, I would say creativity is like a key to be able to be, always been like creative in like drawing stuff since I was a little kid, basically. So I think painting with airbrush, and this is a 100% fabricated response, but painting with airbrush is like triggers your creative mind, and I think that is important when it comes to incident response and threat hunting, to be creative. So I think that's like how they fit together. I wouldn't say necessarily that one benefits the other, but I think the creative mindset is something that gives off to both those sides.
Yeah. Amazing.
I can agree with you. If you are a bit of a having stuff that you can do in another way, you can take that within your current role. For us, it's cybersecurity, but probably if someone has another job, can do it the same. More or less the same way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm an outside the box guy.
Yeah, we definitely know that.
but just don't paint outside of the box.
Exactly.
So, Matthias, to finishing up this session, if you focus why we started this talks regarding the community and the power, in your opinion, how important is the collaboration within the community in the field of cybersecurity? And are there, in your opinion, any or can you share any experience where community efforts made a significant difference in your day-to-day job or at a customer, maybe?
I think so. I mean, besides all the like learning and sharing stuff, I think it's a good way for people that comes into the business to do quick ramp up and learn new things. I always encourage people to be an active part of the community. When I do threat hunting trainings and threat hunting and defender trainings and stuff, I always encourage people to share your queries with the community, because the more people that's sharing with the community, the more they can benefit from the community as well, because that would trigger more people to share with the community. So I think, that's one thing. And also, it's totally outside this, but there's a lot of people in the community. I think this is an important topic. There's a lot of people in the community with different, the mental health in the community. There's a lot of people affected by that. And I think the community and like everyone in the business can do more, both on the like the inclusive side, but also making sure that your coworker and your friend are like feeling well, to get more people to feel well, and also pick up people that that you see starting to fall down this rabbit hole. It could be, I mean, I've like severe ADHD in the back, pushing me forward, of course. But there could be people that have different mental challenges that are not feeling that well. So I think that's something where the community can, I think the community can do much more, but I don't know what we can do for it. Except talking about it, allow ourselves to be vulnerable.
Yeah, I believe we have, sorry, friend, this is also from the MVP community. We have some student partnership that you can take someone with you, and then, but that's more technical. But you are mainly also focusing on the personal level, on the human side.
Yeah,
trying to. That's so that would be amazing.
I prepared a session about the topic. Sometimes I've started sending it to different events. It's a different session to talk about, for sure. I'm not sure how to demo that.
I think that is not quite easy to demo that. But yeah, I know within the MVP community, we have also more like a community about mental health and doing stuff, having the ADHD, and that kind of stuff. If you are facing that, and how are you managing that instead of working in IT or cybersecurity especially? Yeah, and I think a bit of more energy into that should be good. On the other hand, to finish this recording, I have one last question for you, Matthias. What is a personal or professional goal for the coming period for you?
Yeah, I think on a professional side, I'm building a lot of tools lately with GitHub Copilot. Love that thing. So it's, I mean, first thing, but I think a well-deserved vacation. But in terms of goals, I'm like, always do this short-term things, but I think becoming more, or not becoming, but keep on being like this role model for the community, sort of, to be someone that people can rely on and continue to do what we do best. That's my goal.
That's a great goal.
I think that's a good one.
And also drop my ADHD talk at some conference somewhere.
Yeah. Let's do that.
If you need some demo people.
yeah, absolutely.
To wrap things off today's episode of Security MVP Insight, Matthias, thank you for sharing your invaluable expertise on cloud security, trends and best practices and all the stuff that you share. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. It was awesome.
Nice. And to our listeners, thank you for tuning in. If you found today's discussion insightful, be sure to subscribe to our podcast and stay updated on the latest cybersecurity insights. For more of Matthias' insights, be sure to visit the blog on blog.sec-labs.com. Stay tuned for our next episode, where we'll continue to explore the dynamic landscape of cybersecurity. Until next time, stay vigilant and stay secure.